Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email, and it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to the Personal Investor Podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, it's a week in which it's impossible to ignore the impact of politics on our financial lives. That's where we'll be starting today. Elections in France and the UK are of immediate concern, but it's the latest developments in the battle to be the next US president that may turn out to be the most consequential political event of the past week. And then we'll check in on the sometime biggest company in the world, Nvidia. Why are some now doubting its future dominance in AI? If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Markets will have to digest elections on either side of the Channel and the Atlantic Ocean this year. Voting is already underway in the French parliamentary election. The first round poll on Sunday will be followed by a final runoff next weekend. In the UK, voting in the general election begins on Thursday, while in the US, although the vote is not until November, there have been serious suggestions in the past week that current President Joe Biden could be replaced as the Democrat candidate. You would expect all of that to have had some effect on markets. So what has that been? To answer that, as well as talk over the latest at Nvidia, the big company story so far this year, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. Let's start in France, shall we, where voting has already started. What's the latest and how have markets responded?
Yeah, so as you say, it's a two-part election that runs over two weekends, last weekend and then the coming weekend. So what we saw last weekend was, as predicted, the far right did well. They took about 33% of the vote, and then the far left and Emmanuel Macron's sort of centrist bloc sort of split the other vote. So it's quite an even split, but the far right has come out on top. But I think what's most interesting from a market's perspective is that there has been an assumption that the far right have not done sufficiently well that they can secure an absolute majority. And that's the key thing, because politicians hate the compromise and the horse trading that goes along with, you know, what they call cohabitation. So
coalitions,
coalition government. But markets quite like it because it yes. actually constrains the
fudgy,
action
nothing happens.
Of politicians. Yeah. And actually nothing happening from a political perspective is often quite a good thing from an economic and a business perspective.
Yeah. And just rewind to how we got here in France. This is a general election called because really of European parliamentary elections, where the far right did well. Emmanuel Macron's kind of calls their bluff, or sort of, you know, brings it to a head and says, let's have a general election. The market didn't like that initial EU election result because of the strength of the far right, because there could be the potential for them to take the reins more generally, actually, and in other European countries as well, other far right parties. This first round in France, which could have produced an overall majority for the National Rally Party, didn't do that. So some sort of moving back from that sort of more extreme position, and in fact markets liked that, didn't they?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the big concern is that, you know, you get this big swing to the right. It kind of undermines the whole sort of European project, if you like. It undermines the fiscal discipline that's built into the to membership of the European Union.
Immigration, big issue, free labour movement, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and also the sort of the idea of, you know, heavily populist spending. So, you know, I mean, going back, you know, in the UK context, going back to that whole sort of unfunded tax cuts thing that we had under the short-lived Liz Truss government. So I think, you know, markets are generally suspicious and nervous of a big shift to the right, but a small shift to the right where there isn't really a majority and the ability of the ruling party to really push through a radical agenda is reduced. That's quite nice for markets.
Yeah, and just finally on France, there's also this dimension around different Eurozone countries having different fiscal policies, which this might lead to, or and certainly if a high spending party got into power, you have a big difference between, say, France and Germany. You have big spreads opening up between their different bonds. I'm not an expert on that, but it's something the market doesn't like.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we saw on the morning after, Monday morning, was we saw spreads coming in, absolute level of bond yields coming down slightly. So, there was an impact on the equity market, but there was also, probably more importantly, an impact on the bond market.
A calming impact.
Yeah, calming impact that it just looks like a more settled situation.
Okay, well, let's move to the UK because we've got voting opening on Thursday, of course, on the 4th of July. Look, we have covered a lot of this ground on recent pod episodes, so we'll try not to retread too much of that, Tom. But surely we can say now that markets have priced in a Labour victory. That's what we all expect to happen. That's what the polls suggest. Who knows the extent of that, but that is what's expected. And given that that's what's expected, markets don't appear to be too worried. FTSE very high, things generally calm.
Yes, and I think you're right that the market has priced in an outcome which is, in line with the opinion polls. It looks very likely that Labour will form the next government, and that they will do so with a pretty secure majority. Now, I mean, it may be a very big majority, it may be slightly less. I mean, often elections are closer than the opinion polls suggest, because people get in the voting booth and they actually vote how they always have done. But, I think anything other than a Labour majority would be a pretty seismic shock for the market. And so markets are very good at factoring in things that, they can predict.
And from that point of view, Boris Johnson back in 2019, he had a big majority, 80 odds, quite a big majority. And so really, from the market's point of view, and from a practical political point of view, less than 50, maybe that's difficult for sort of tangential political reasons, but anywhere between sort of 50 to 100 and sort of, 200, which is at the top end of expectations, it's all kind of the same, isn't it? Just Labour in control, not much to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, any majority of that size that you've described means that they can enact a programme. They can do so in the knowledge that they're unlikely to be defeated. So you get this stability of government. And that actually is what markets crave. I mean, I did some analysis of all the parliaments going back 60 years, back to 1964 and the Labour government then. There isn't a huge amount of, I think we've discussed this before, there isn't a huge amount of correlation between market performance and which party is in power. But there is some correlation between the stability of the government, whether there's a majority, and market performance. Markets do better when they know what to expect.
Yeah, and that's actually more specifically true in some industries where they need continuity of planning and investment. Even just having the same minister in charge, that can be quite good when there's big policy decisions that affect business. The market then may be calm. Household finances could be affected. Labour have said that they're not going to put up any of the big three taxes, income tax, national insurance or VAT. Other taxes exist. CGT has been spoken about. IHT has been spoken about. They're not going to say anything before Thursday, but were they to win, the questions will begin to come in really on their plans. They've said they're going to open up the books, which is what politicians always say. That annoys the experts because they say, well, there are no books. You have the books, yeah. You can open them now, sort of.
You already know, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. When might there be an indication about further plans that Labour has around tax?
Well, Labour have indicated that they're looking for one big fiscal event a year rather than the two we've got used to, which again is, I think, a good thing. It creates, less fluidity, more predictability about the fiscal position. So I think that the expectation is that the first budget that we will see will be in the autumn, possibly in September before the party conferences. Actually, I'd say probably more likely just after the party conferences. So we may have to wait till October for the budget. But I don't think that we should expect, a kind of emergency budget, immediately after they come into power. I think we've got 3 or 4 months for these for these stories about the taxes that you mentioned to unfold. And we know certain things. We know that they've ruled out raising, you know, some of the big taxes, but there are big question marks, particularly over the two you mentioned, their capital gains tax and inheritance tax.
Okay, well, we'll no doubt return to this in the weeks and months ahead, Tom. Let's move on for now to the US, because it was, by common consensus, a bad night for Joe Biden at a recent TV debate with Donald Trump, of course, the Republican candidate. Some have now even speculated that Biden could be replaced in the race. That seems to... they're doing their best to kind of dampen that sort of talk. We're here to look at things from a market point of view, of course. Is there anything to suggest what the market reaction to this might be, to Biden maybe not being the candidate?
Well, I think that there are two things to consider here. One is just the sort of general sense of chaos that it would engender. You know, I mean, the way that these elections have run in recent years is that it's been pretty much... settled by the summer before the November election who the candidates are going to be. I mean, you actually have to go back to the 1960s, really, when the summer conferences for the Congress, I can't remember exactly what they're called, but anyway, the conventions where nominally the candidate is decided, it was just a rubber stamp you have to go back to the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson stood down, and there was actually a genuine contest for contested convention to see who would be the candidate. So if that were to happen, this would be a change. I think it would create some uncertainty. But if you look, actually, if you stand back from the race and look at the two parties, they're not actually that different. I mean, both parties are actually quite free spending parties.
Yeah.
The US is running a very sizable budget deficit, something like 7%. So it's taking in 7% less than it's spending. That's arguably unsustainable, but neither side seems to be opposing that. So that's really setting the investment and the market agenda in the US. It's, you know, how sustainable is this budget deficit? How sustainable are the borrowings? And what's going to happen to taxes and to spending? And really, I don't think the name on the ballot paper makes a huge amount of difference to those fundamental questions.
Yeah, I think with the US, it's a case that it's not like politics won't matter, because it probably will, but the market doesn't really know how it will matter. And it's close. You know, the US election is always incredibly close. It's a two-horse race, and if you look at the underlying vote shares, they're typically very, very close. You've got that issue with the presidency versus the majorities in the Senate and the House of Representatives. As you go back to that point you made about markets, they basically like stalemates. They would quite like it to
be. They do. And in the US, you often get these stalemates because the system was devised, you know, hundreds of years ago, a couple of hundred years ago, it was actually devised to create stalemates.
You have
a check on the power of the executive in the White House with Congress, and very often the colour of the party in the White House is different from the majority in Congress, and that's ultimately a good thing.
Okay, well, let's leave the politics there for now, Tom, and just move briefly on to something else I wanted to talk about today, which was Nvidia. You've written about Nvidia in the past week. It's definitely been the big company story this year, and actually probably the company story for many years. Actually, astronomical growth in the share price last year, but then this year has put that in the shade. But some big wobbles and volatility recently. So what's been going on?
Yeah, so we had a big downdraft in the Nvidia share price, 13% in three trading sessions a week or so ago, and you know, there was a lot of hand wringing about this. Is this the bursting of the AI bubble? Has it gone too far? And you had to put this in context. I mean, Nvidia shares had risen by about 80% in less than a year. I mean, you know, I mean, that is phenomenal.
In less than a few months, I think in year to date it was 150% or something crazy.
So I mean, it is a staggering rise in the share price. And this is not a penny share. You know, this is one of the biggest companies in the world. Briefly, it was the biggest company in the world, and it has risen tenfold in about 2 years. I mean, it's a staggering story. I do think it's the most extraordinary single stock story in the time that I've been involved with the markets. So that was the context. I mean, there are legitimate questions about whether, you know, the AI story has become overblown. It's all unproven. We don't know what it's going to be. It seems to be, you know, I mean, there is a huge difference between this AI story and previous bubbles that we've had, whether that's the dot-com bubble or the Japanese bubble or the Nifty 50 in the 1970s. These are genuinely profitable companies. This appears to be a story which is genuinely changing, potentially changing the productivity, the profitability of global business. You know, there is a good reason why these shares should be so in demand. But as ever, you look at the share prices, you look at the charts, and you think, there are some remarkable similarities between the exponential rise in Nvidia share price and, for example, the exponential rise in Cisco or Intel 25 years ago. Or even I saw a comparison made with RCA, the radio stock in the 1920s, because, yeah, you know, radio was the AI of the 1920s, and it caused, you know, a similar bubble in stock markets, which ultimately ended with the 1929 crash. So it's right that people should be asking questions about whether this is justified or not. It doesn't feel like we're quite at those levels yet.
Yeah, and that huge volatility, a lot of which has been recovered, right, in the past week or so.
Yep.
That's to be expected after those astronomical gains. There'll always be people that speculated quite late in the process, and then they're taking profits, or other people are taking profits. So you get these ups and downs. That's part of that kind of astronomical rise. But it's also true, as you suggest, that people are beginning to put together the kind of intellectual case for why Nvidia specifically might not fulfill this insane potential that it has. Mm. It does make lots of money. You know, that's a difference between it and previous examples of stocks like that. But there are some fundamental things going on with Nvidia's products and who Nvidia's customers are that make you wonder whether it's all sustainable.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when you compare this to the dot-com bubble, that what happened in the dot-com bubble was that basically anyone who could demonstrate any kind of connection with, you know, the growth of the internet, you know, was afforded a premium valuation rating. And something similar seems to be happening with AI. And where this looks slightly puzzling is you've got Nvidia, which is selling these, you know, expensive chips to other big technology companies, the likes of Apple and Microsoft,
and that's one of the reasons people like Nvidia, isn't it? Because it's not an AI product; it's the facilitation of that through the chips, isn't it?
It is the facilitation, but then that begs the question of, you know, who are the likely beneficiaries of the AI revolution going to be? In exactly the same way as 25 years ago, you would have said, who are the likely beneficiaries of the internet revolution going to be? And a lot of the money was put at the building blocks of the internet. So Cisco and Intel were building the networks, the hardware, the plumbing, if you like, of the internet. Now, in fact, in reality, the beneficiaries of the internet have been the companies which have been able to use that plumbing to build their businesses, and that's why we saw big rise in the share prices of Cisco and Intel, and then big falls in the dot-com crash after 2000. So there is a question mark. Is Nvidia going to be the biggest beneficiary, or is it going to be someone else completely? Is it going to be another big tech company, or is it going to be a company that we haven't even heard of? And those are legitimate questions.
Okay. We've covered a whole load today, Tom, so I'm going to call time there. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorised financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.